This is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SusD, on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, so this is the Q&A from the Student Divestment from Fossil Fuels campaign. And the Q&A was really good. This is not available anywhere else, but here on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. They have several tools from people in the audience who are some fairly experienced activists. So there's some tips here. If you want to do this at your school, get your school to stop investing in fossil fuels and war, for that matter, since war is the biggest carbon emitter there is. We don't really need wars in the 21st century, I don't think, anymore with modern communications. But that's beside the point. And then, after the student divest Q&A, I did an interview. They were outside the fishbowl here at the U of O during PILC. I talked to them about both the union efforts to unionize the workers at the U of O and the student workers unionization at the U of O and the Starbucks unionization of the Starbucks at the U of O. So those two are follow the Q&A from the student divestment, very important keystone in the fossil fuel, the movement to get off fossil fuels and produce your own power and get rooftop solar. You know, my thing, too, is we need rooftop solar because there's no reason to run a wire from a centralized power plant to my house when you can produce your own power. And, you know, Tesla had a way. There's energy bombarding the planet. There should be a way to literally get energy out of the air by now instead of paying a centralized corporation for your electricity use. And, of course, we need much more conservation. All right, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
Yeah, so if you guys have any questions, we can have this it's just a conversation. It doesn't need to be too formal. Yeah.
The way I see it, and tell me if you think differently, but really the risks are like more long-term risks. Mm-hmm. Like in the short term, you know, if you look at the balance sheets of the big oil companies from 2022, they were gangbusters. Like the profits were crazy, mm-hmm. right? But the long-term risks are enormous. And so how do you guys view fiduciary duty in terms of like the scope of risk and like how does that play out?
Okay. I guess in my mind, I know that often suits for like fiduciary duties and private things are usually kind of quick or like that it's not really long-term because you can't go back too far, or you don't know what's going to happen when you make that decision. These people can't necessarily be punished for every decision they make that doesn't end up making money. But at the same time, I think that they have to consider it. I think that the fact that it's not a short-term goal and it's more long-term doesn't mean that we don't need like short-term action for it to happen. Obviously, you know, we've been talking about 7 years at this conference all day, every day. And I guess, I think that fiduciaries apply in the long term, especially like hindsight 2020, forward sight 15-20, like you know that it's coming, we know that it's coming, we can see it. I mean, MIT's letter to their attorney general, which was was written with the Climate Defense Project attorneys, there's mentions these fiduciary duties too, so they are, you know, using them to push it forward.
I would say that the endowment which they are managing has been built on the long term, and you know, the endowment is meant to sustain the university for years and years into the future. So your investments should be in alignment with how long this endowment is supposed to support the university, which is until forever.
Yes.
I have a comment, a question, and then almost certainly a follow-up comment. First, thank you for a wonderful presentation. I think it's an injustice you were put on the last panel because there were at least 20 non-UO faculty here this weekend who really should have been in this presentation. So my question is, you mentioned faculty, I think, only about three times. In your efforts, have you tried engaging with your faculty, and especially faculty boards like Faculty Senate?
Yes, we have. And we have found that Faculty Senates, we were doing this in the time of COVID. So, the Senate didn't meet for like a year.
Really?
They didn't meet for pretty much the whole first year of COVID. They just kept delaying the meetings. We did have champions on that faculty senate, and we noted that they had way more sway over the president than our, student government or our governments or our student senate. So we have been working with them. It's just really slow, and they've also come into problems with getting widespread support. I think a lot of our faculty are spread really thin, and I think that is the way to move forward, though, because building these coalitions between faculty and students is how to really build up that political power. It's just been unfortunate that the Faculty Senate hasn't been as engaged as we would.
So I wouldn't be discouraged by that, especially when you're putting together like guides for other student organizations mm-hmm. to do this. I'm the chair of the Faculty Senate at my institution, and I know that we would be very receptive, or at least the younger faculty would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're currently mostly directed towards contractual disputes, mm-hmm. Unfortunately. And even in that setting, boomer faculty tend to not have any interest in pushing social justice issues,
yeah.
even for their colleagues. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons that Texas UF found us to be all that receptive. But I really do encourage you to include more of that in like your guides and things for other students, because at other places it might be different.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of institutions don't have any student presence mm-hmm. of their faculty senates.
Yeah.
I'm currently in the process of overhauling our bylaws and everything to bring in student representation onto the Senate. Because it absolutely needs to have a student voice
mm-hmm.
on it.
Yeah, I'll just give you one more example. I think, the University of Texas is a unique case, and we had my freshman year of college several years ago, we had our faculty senate actually they put out a statement against the building of a new supercomputer on our Pickle Research campus. And, that was also met with inaction because I think at these public universities, especially in conservative states, the voice of our government holds a lot more weight at the university than even our faculty. Although we do think that, working with faculty is essential for building those connections within university administration, and then hopefully getting our president to actually talk to the investment body and kind of speak on our behalf. So, it's definitely a partnership that should exist. It's just still overcoming those power dynamics is a major struggle.
Find faculty that are interested.
Mm-hmm.
Enviro studies departments, pretty much any humanities faculty, law fac, I think
mm-hmm.
you'd have success finding allies.
Thank you. Yes?
I apologize, I missed the beginning. You may have mentioned this, but I see that University of Texas owns 2 million acres and gets royalties from oil and natural gas on that property.
Yes.
So it's like not just an investor, it's an oil and gas participant
yes.
in a big way.
Yeah.
You would think that there would be Texas has more wind than any other state, and there's a potential for a lot of wind and solar going forward.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that as a landowner, there would be a compelling business case that that royalty stream is going to die
mm-hmm.
over the next 20 years, whatever, and that the university needs to secure future revenues and should be making sure that its wind development is going on to that land and solar is being built there, and that it's going to get a similar royalty like farmers do in Texas who have wind farms on their land.
Exactly. That was an argument that we used in these meetings with our administration. We said, you know, we can't keep drilling for oil and gas on these lands forever. Like, are there any efforts to transition this to wind or solar or to produce or to lease it out to any other industry to generate the revenue that we need? And the answer was just, you know, that is something that we're working on. There's research in progress. We can't offer you any more updates. And I was like, well, students want to be updated on this. We want to know what is going on. Why aren't you publishing this research that you're doing on the university lands?
Yeah.
And still we were met with silence. So, I think that this comes back to the issue of transparency. And that's why this movement is really about addressing kind of university governance in general and where students lie in that process. So, yeah, I appreciate that comment.
Where's the Alumni Association on this? You said that they wait you out until you graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you all have alumni associations, or where are they on this?
Yeah, we have reached out to our alumni associations. The unfortunate case at the University of Texas is they really listen to those powerful alumni, the alumni who make the biggest donations. And the majority of those people are also in the oil and gas industry. So we have worked with alumni. We got alumni to support our petition and our divestment proposal. I think it's just a matter of who those alumni are. I think that's also another avenue that we need to build up the coalition between.
Well, but isn't there a way to keep in contact with the people that were with your cause?
Absolutely, yeah. I think better communication is definitely a mode that we should establish between these groups in order to keep tab on those movements that are happening on campus. As undergraduate students, we're not very organized. If you can look at the archives of student organizations on campus, it's a little cluttered, to say the least. I think building up that communication and the organizational structure between these organizations is a real solution for keeping track of the different movements on campus. Definitely something to work on.
I would say that like part of that too is getting graduate students involved with it who, you know, may stay on for the university for longer. I think a lot of times, at least, you know, for me on my undergrad experience, because I had a little bit of time between undergrad and law school, but you kind of sort of forget, or you move on, or your life changes, and these pressing issues that like you were passionate about, that you live with every day, you kind of start to forget. So like reaching out to these alumni, often it's kind of the last thing on their plate, because they're like, I already did this work as much as I could,
mm-hmm.
and sort of kind of move on. And it is part of the like structure of maintaining the group to like keep, these like programs recycle basically every couple years. And part of the movement needs to be focusing on starting when these students come in, and really getting them active and involved in these things and continuing it going, and like sort of kind of teaching each other through trial and error how to keep it going, how to stay involved, like keeping these like maybe newsletters or something like that. But
yeah, and in my experience, this is my sister, and she actually got me interested in this topic when I started law school. And so I was trying to see at University of Missouri, so it's under Mizzou, right? University of Missouri in Kansas City is under Mizzou. So I was trying to see if there's a Mizzou coalition, student activism that does this, or at UMKC. And there was something, but it pretty much died out when the pandemic started. So the last thing was in 2019. And so I had tried to reach out to those people that were in articles and that were in the student org, and I just didn't get a response. And so it's really hard to find these people after they've graduated because their emails change. Maybe they're doing something else. Maybe they don't care as much as they used to. But it is really hard to start a campaign when one has died out. And so I think that really just the issue that we really have right now coming from the Midwest and the South is just getting people to care. Because people can say, yeah, recycling, whatever, but do they really care that much? And, you know, our university is a lot smaller than UT. We aren't as invested as UT, but we still have an issue, right? There is still money invested in the fossil fuel industry. So, honestly, with schools like ours, which is different than probably this school that we're at right now, it's just getting people to care, getting those students involved, getting that faculty involved, and really starting that campaign, because once it dies out, it's really hard to get it back on its feet again.
I think it also comes back to the resources for students. I mean, I was a part of building an organization that was trying to keep divestment as a long-term movement on campus. So half the time I wasn't even working on direct action. I wasn't working on communicating with administration. I was just trying to get freshmen through the front door of our meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I was just trying to recruit people. I was trying to build the structure of an organization. I mean, that takes so much planning and so much energy. I don't know how many... what did we call them? Derek also was in this organization with me. We called them structure meetings.
Yeah.
We're building the structure of this organization so that we can maintain this movement of divestment. And we didn't really have those resources. We didn't have funding from the university to put all of these hours, I don't know, probably 20 hours a week, trying to build an organization that could maintain the movement. So getting students those resources they need in order to actually build a movement that lasts, I think, is important. Derek, go ahead.
I was just going to add that, yeah, I think the biggest issue is building a structure that will actually last, because people tend, it'll get, at least in our experience at UT, it tends to be like a few people carrying the mantle who are really passionate, and then they get burnt out, and then other people take it on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there needs to be, maybe the solution is like connecting with other local like activists or nonprofit groups that do have a stable structure, and making sure that they have the alumni and the faculty contacts that they can pass on to the next generation of students, because students a lot of times really just do go missing after they graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of that like institutional activist knowledge is just gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
maintaining institutional memory within student orgs is very difficult, but it has gotten easier. I've worked with a law and political economy group, if either of the lawyers on the panel know LPE, progressive economics focused social justice movement. And one of the key priorities when we set the LPE group up was to ensure that they had record management systems. We were using Discord for
mm-hmm.
internal communications at first, but we've moved to a private element server, which is an open source chat software, because you can maintain permanent records, so you can always have these. And it's important things like using cloud storage spaces and stuff that's accessible to the public
mm-hmm.
that can really help preserve this institutional memory. So
right.
Say you two, you know, graduate whenever you do and nobody takes over for you, but then 2 years down the road, someone does, they can open that G Drive folder back up and
great.
See everything that you've done.
Yeah.
And just having really good documentation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Which, I mean, I know in any type of social justice or environmental justice type group, it can feel weird having your names preserved, because as you've already found out in your young lives, university administrators are essentially Nazis with suits instead of jackets.
They love to surveil our meetings.
That's frightening.
Yeah, it is frightening. This is going on a tangent, but I just did some archive research and found so many like planted students in these meetings, recording the meeting minutes for the public investigator to then file this.
This was
it's
in
insane.
The 1960s,
right?
Yeah,
okay.
It was.
But the fact that universities are capable of this and working with police like that is, yeah, anyways, it's scary to have your name recorded.
I mean, an alternative to that, to prevent them from doing that and get them in trouble for doing that, is to move off campus.
Yeah.
Hold meetings off campus. Don't organize this directly through, I'm guessing you two are in like an environmental, some sort of actual club organization under UT.
Mm-hmm.
Move this actual movement out of the club. Use the club to organize,
mm-hmm.
but just move all of your activities, your meetings, all of that into a private sphere. And then, you know, you have a lot more protections.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what Texas has for privacy laws and things
mm-hmm.
like that. Probably very little when it comes to protecting looters. But, you know, you will have more protection from that.
Yeah.
And it's an idea. I've suggested that to other people in other places. And I think it can be important.
So here in Oregon, we have a Divest Oregon
mm-hmm.
coalition, which is working at the state level to try to find some levers to for the state treasury to divest through policy changes, legislation. There's a bill pending in our legislative session right now. A lot of that, those public funds are like retirement funds
mm-hmm,
for
yeah.
public employees.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the state, at least in Oregon, I don't think the state treasurer manages the university funds.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just wondering, in Texas and Missouri, do you have those statewide coalitions as well, looking at, you know, the state's funds, and have you coordinated with them at all?
I have not known any statewide divestment movement. I know that organizations like Divest Invest also work with groups to work at divestment at all sorts of levels. But I have not come into contact with any group that's doing that at the state level, but that would be really interesting to look out for and to try to build.
Yeah. And at Missouri, we don't even have a club that's doing this right now. Like I said, they dismantled in 2019. And I've tried to reach out to people at Mizzou and our own campus undergrads to maybe get something going. I've tried law students. They're very busy and don't seem to care as much as I do. So... again, it's we come from states where people are still arguing that climate change isn't even real,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of, it's, and you know, we've talked about this coming from being at this all weekend, like it feels like our efforts are a bit different than in Oregon and places on the coast, because you guys are already kind of a couple steps ahead of us.
Yeah.
You know, we're still trying to convince people it's an issue and that we need to get on board with it, you know, so it's a bit more tough, I think, coming from where we are in the country, and we don't have those resources and groups of people that are as strong as some places in Oregon. So really right now we're just trying to get people to care, get people to come to these meetings, and then we could probably start going for things like that, because that's really interesting and a great avenue to go after. And I think also a thing that would be really great is to kind of find a platform where all these different groups can talk and talk about what's worked and what hasn't worked and different avenues to go forward with this, because it's so, you know, separated right now with all the different universities. But I think something like that would be really beneficial, so we can kind of, you know, not try the same things over and over again that hasn't worked, but maybe go towards the things that have worked and more focus our efforts towards that. But right now, that doesn't exist.
And on that point, at some point, the blue states that have made progress in the divest movement are going to have to provide some tools for everybody else, because the discrepancies in the politics are enormous.
Yeah.
You know, once Oregon does that, which, you know, when could that be? At least we have some, you know, persuasive things to bring up to these people. And I do think that we need to, in our states at least, focus a lot on the political part of it for students in electing an attorney general who may do something.
Yeah.
Because the ones we have now won't. I don't know if Texas ever will. I don't know if Missouri ever will.
They've been saying it for 10 years.
But, you know, and the keynote speaker talked about, you know, it's picking the boss that you want for your state or whatever when you're voting. And I think that it isn't something we touched a lot about in our campaign or our PowerPoint, but just the focusing on like helping these people get elected, like building support behind people who will take these steps for us. So if we can't get faculty involved and bring it in through the judicial system, we can keep bringing these letters can change, make them do something, because they have standing. They don't have to have this group of people all come together and do it. So, like, yeah.
I will say that there are some avenues for these students to work together across the country. But it's kind of similar where it's a Slack channel called Student Climate Coalition, you know, and like that's not going to last forever. And similarly, like organizations that have dedicated to connecting students across these movements, like Divest Ed, which was the champion for climate movements across universities, they just ran out of funding and they had to dissolve their chapter. And for a lot of students, they were our go-to on helping us develop these campaign tactics and connecting us with students at other universities so that we can work together and build political power. So it's really frustrating to see the system that we're in not, you know, we don't have the infrastructure to support these movements all the time, but that also shows that there is a gap and there's still work to be done in order to build these connections and maybe a more structured way to make it last and to strengthen it. So, yeah, I appreciate all of your comments and the ideas you're generating.
John Doerr. You'd think there would be money if John Doerr can give $1 billion to Stanford to establish some permanent program, mm-hmm. that, you know, there would be some money for coordinating among universities and creating an institutional memory and things like that, and a database of, you know, position papers and things that would be usable. You'd think there, that it would be possible to.
I think it comes back to students being seen as real political players in this and real people who have the stakehold in the future.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people don't want to give undergrad money for initiatives or students, you know, it's hard to support us as real activists in this.
What about the tech community in Austin with Tesla and Dell and others? And I mean, AMD, there are all these tech companies there that must have business opportunities in climate transition and be pushing it. You would think that there would be supportive groups in the community.
I will say that we have not really tried to partner with organizations such as Tesla because we don't really see our missions as in alignment, although it would be great to have some support from them. I think it comes back to our social justice mission and not wanting to feel like we have to also answer to a corporate player. But at the same time, I mean, we're not going to turn down money, so that is an idea.
It might not be Tesla, but it might be a community of people having to work at Tesla or in solar, you know, residential solar Powerwall or, you know, EV or whatever, who would be a constituency sort of to support.
I just had a thought in terms of like these letters to attorneys general, and articulating the harm of this. I think I recognize you two now. You two were at the Beyond Toxics panel yesterday.
Yes,
we were. Yeah.
So something that just popped into my head is you can articulate it beyond climate change. You can have, you know, reach out to traditionally marginalized communities in which, you know, they're suffering, like West Albany is under gas stations being on, you know, 4 per fucking intersection apparently in some areas, and using that harm to try to get standing to make these complaints.
That's a great idea.
Obviously climate change is the actual issue or the biggest issue here, but it might be worth exploring those smaller harms.
That's a great idea. A plaintiff with a little bit more standing, maybe, to get it to stick.
Yeah, because if you're having standing, or if people are having standing problems with these complaints, then, you know, community members, surely, a court should find standing for it.
Yeah, that's a great idea, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cool. Yes.
You mentioned that this is going on in the U.S. I just wanted to mention, I don't know if it got a lot of publicity in the United States. I live and teach in a law school in Japan, but the German Constitutional Court the year before last, I don't know if you heard, they basically struck down the entire German climate transition plan on an intergenerational justice theory and said this is not aggressive enough because you're denying the next generation is the same standard of living that the current generation has because of the CO2 budget, basically. You haven't pushed an aggressive enough curve. Mm-hmm. And so you're mandating that the quality of life is going to go down for your grandchildren and children. Mm-hmm. It really is an intergenerational argument, and it won under that constitution. I don't think it's going to win under the U.S. Constitution, but yeah. It, as a political argument, it really is saying you, the current generation, the boomers, you're polluting and ruining our world, that we're going to live in, basically. Mm-hmm. It's a very much an intergenerational argument.
Do you know about that,
Emily? Not exactly, no.
I'm sure I probably could find a copy, an English language copy of that opinion. I mean,
great.
Well, that'd be a great, email it to us. Yeah, I mean, it's always good to have some sort of structure where things have worked, right? Because we just need something to work at this point. So I think throwing everything out there and other countries' law, legal complaints and efforts aren't necessarily going to be right binding, but it is persuasive. And it is saying, hey, everyone else in the world is doing this. There are efforts in other places. And we need to follow because this is a global issue, right?
Yeah.
If we are the only ones doing it, it's not going to fix the issue. We all are in it together.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a great resource, and it's definitely something to look at, just like other countries that are doing this work.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
All
right. Any final questions or thoughts or comments?
Thanks, guys.
Thank you guys so much.
So why are you out here in front of the EMU holding a sign that says no contract, no coffee?
Because, today one of our coworkers was wrongfully fired and she was just not let know about anything, and we're with the union, and so we're treated differently than other Starbucks in the area. We get less things than other Starbucks in the area, and so we're just trying to be equal to them, get treated equally than every other worker that works for here.
So because you're at the university, you get paid even less?
I don't think because we're at the university, just we're a union store.
So you are a union store?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's wrong then with, I thought you wanted a union store.
Yeah, because we're trying to fight for better work conditions just in the first place, not for the better work conditions even for the unionized stores.
All right, so you're standing out here, your sign says, in front of the EMU at the U of O, your sign says, Starbucks stop union busting. What is different about the Starbucks employees here at the EMU are different? What is different about them?
We take, our list of responsibilities is going to be different than those at other Starbucks. For instance, we don't have bathrooms or lobbies to clean. We also take in a capacity that's a lot higher than other Starbucks. We frequently see triple digit amounts of customers in half an hour increments on our busy times, which is a very high number. And then we also don't really make tips here. Being on a college campus, we don't have credit card tipping. That's something that only non-unionized stores have. And college kids also don't really carry cash, so we are very single digit amounts of dollars for a week. That's how much tips we get. Whereas if I cover a shift at any other Starbucks in town, I'll probably be making double digits in a week.
All right, but so there's an issue with, there's no bathrooms in the fishbowl.
There are bathrooms. We just have to walk through them. We don't have any private bathrooms. We don't have the responsibility of cleaning for them. But a downside of this, we also don't have any employee break areas that are specific to us. Or we don't have any time for, the place we would spend break, it's the same place our manager is sitting, which is not a great kind of way to have to take your break if you're sitting there and your manager is also right there, especially when a manager is the vessel in which Starbucks a lot of the time will union bust. So that's a very uncomfortable dynamic to have. Another thing that's weird is that if someone's being unruly in our lobby, we aren't allowed to just kick them out. We have to call the campus police, who then comes and determines whether or not they have to be kicked out. So if we feel unsafe, we don't have the power to kick someone out. We have to go through a second, like a third party, I guess, to get that to happen. It's been really frustrating because we've had like a pattern of behavior from specific individuals in the past who will come up and steal food and harass customers. And the only thing we can do about that is just call someone else about it. Other Starbucks stores, they're allowed to just like get someone out of the lobby, threaten to call the police. We can't do that.
Well, so you fear for your own safety, sort of. There's a potential for your own safety.
There's a lot of safety concerns, especially because with the capacity, I mentioned we have like a really high volume of customers too. For how small we are, that's a very big issue because we're running around doing a lot of stuff. We'll get throngs of people in this area where like these two tables won't be able to be sat at because people are standing all around there. You can't walk through here without telling people to go through. It just causes a lot of safety issues.
And so what about collective bargaining? Are you guys with the other unions? There's no difference in your bargaining power, is there?
Our bargaining power is the exact same. And the thing with that is they also just haven't been bargaining with us and the other stores. They just walk out or they refuse to bargain. They'll hear our demands and they'll just sit and they'll say that they're like talking about it, but in reality they're really not doing anything. They'll come back at the end of the bargaining session. They'll say, okay, let's go next time. We'll meet again next time. We'll try to bargain then.
What type of benefits does Starbucks offer? Do you guys get a pension plan?
I can't remember if we get a pension plan. I think, if I had to say it, I would say we do. Starbucks does offer some pretty good benefits in comparison with other fast food places. But if you compare it to any other corporate job or any job that's like an office job with a real benefits package, it doesn't seem like something that significant. The benefits they're offering are more just like, here's benefits that other fast food places don't offer, so we seem better. But in reality, the wages still started at the federal floor for wages. They've been barely hiking those up throughout it just to feel like they're feeding us more breadcrumbs. It's still a really hard place. I know we do get, we do have things like some insurance that we can get if we're scheduled for 20 hours a week that we can, and that's a benefit we can get. We don't have to be full-time. But every quarter, Starbucks will cut hours and people will become ineligible for that because they'll get less than 20 hours a week. And that's something that they'll do without even talking to the partners. They won't bargain for that. They'll just decide this is a way we can make extra money. It's by cutting hours at the store and paying people less. And then that really stretches us thin. Where's our resources?
Well, and so what about corporate management of Starbucks? They, you know, do you know what the ratio is to pay between your pay and the heads of Starbucks, and how much money does Starbucks make?
I know Starbucks has been consistently recording record profits every quarter. I don't know what the pay difference is between us and the higher levels of Starbucks management. I think someone else implied to me that they know what it is, so I might look that up later. But I've heard district managers make a disgusting amount of money compared to what we make as a barista.
And then, so what is the impact, do you think, of unionization in general in America? If you guys are successful, this will spread to other businesses.
Oh, certainly. I think this is a very big step for the food service industry in general. The food service industry has already been shaking throughout the pandemic. We've seen Panda raise their, Panda Express has raised their wages up to $16 an hour, and managers make, I think, six digits a year, like on a yearly salary. Taco Bell now pays, I think, $15 an hour. A lot of fast food places are raising their wages, but if we get a successful union campaign going and we get successful bargaining to happen, I think that'll pave the way for other fast food, you know, chain employees to see, wow, they've got, you know, a way higher wage than us. They've got benefits. They have like work weeks that work for them. I think after this goes, and especially with a lot of the publicity that the Starbucks Workers United campaign has had, I think it's a great way to pave the road for the rest of the food service industry to follow suit.
Well, all right, and so one more thing, and then I'll let you go. Yeah. I used to work grocery, and what they do is they cut your hours so that you cannot get benefits.
Exactly.
Is that something that they are doing a lot of?
Oh, of course, yeah. Every quarter, they'll cut hours for partners, and they have hour minimums, like weekly hour minimums you have to work for both benefits like that. And also, another benefit they give us is an Arizona State University. They'll give us term by term some classes, but you have to meet an hour minimum for that across the term. And when you cut hours like that and you're not asking baristas for that permission, you're putting them below the threshold that they need for those classes. So they've cut hours I know at least two partners at our store that have had hours cut below those thresholds.
For college credit, you mean?
Yes, for college credit and getting classes and getting educated.
All right, anything else?
Not that I can think of. I loved your questions.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, so we're here in front of the EMU, the Student Union Fishbowl, and you're holding a sign that says "Kicking ass for the working class." Who do you represent?
So I'm one of the lead organizers for the UO Student Workers Undergrad Unionization effort. We've been fighting for the past 6 months to unionize undergrad student workers to fight for better pay, working conditions, and collective power on campus. That's who I represent here.
All right, and so one of your workers has been fired.
So what happened is about a week or two ago, one of our workers, Will Garahan, was fired from Fresh Corner Market. And then today, a Starbucks worker, which is not represented by our union, but our other student workers on campus, who had been there for 7 years, was fired. So we're here in solidarity with Starbucks Workers United. Because the university and private interests on campus in general are cracking down on unionization. We felt that, and they're feeling that here today.
So they're using similar tactics to what Amazon and other corporations use.
Oh, absolutely. And it really sheds light on the fact that both corporations don't have the interests of the public in mind, that they're fighting against people that want to exploit workers, pay them poorly, treat them poorly. And when people fight to improve their conditions, these workers are punished instead of actually like being rewarded for their collective power. And even at what is supposed to be a public university, the University of Oregon, a place where like public interests are supposed to be represented, you're seeing the exact same behavior.
All right, so where, I don't understand where the money is going. Who is making money? Why don't they want to pay the a union wage to and have a union at the U of O?
I mean, really, the influence of private donors on the university and the influence of private power in general makes it so the university does not want to treat its students or its workers fairly despite their public messaging. They're more interested in developing athletics, developing like kind of high-income housing off-campus than they are on reinvesting the money that they are getting from donors and from the state, and especially from its students, into education, into good wages. And ultimately, they don't want to give up collective power. They don't want to fulfill the promises of a public education, of the public having an influence over their education and getting good education, accessible education, good wages, and good working conditions broadly. They're more interested in protecting the status quo, catering to private donors, and that's reflected in who's on the Board of Trustees and who holds and controls the levels of power on campus.
All right, and so what about the developers in the town? They've separated out the athletics program from the U of O endowment. Is that true?
My understanding is that that is true, but what you see is the separation of funds, athletics, between the broader UO funding still contributes to decreasing education standards, to decreasing compensation for workers, because when athletics are developing, when these like larger buildings are developing, it grows campus, and the rest of campus funding is not growing to match that level of growth. So academic departments are spread thin, more workers need to be hired, and they need to keep wages low because there's not more money for paying workers well, for paying faculty well, or paying departments well. And the ultimate purpose of the University of Oregon to educate people, to make sure that people have like an accessible education, is being undermined and not funded, while athletics and expensive housing is.
Because, and so the U of O has the lowest student subsidy rate.
Yeah, so if you look both in Oregon and at the national level, the University of Oregon receives very, very little public funding. Oregon, I think, is 46th in the nation on how much public funding they receive, which is not what you'd expect for kind of a liberal state like Oregon. And what that means is not only are we not making money to like sustain ourselves, but it means the University of Oregon is increasingly compromised by private donors, and which I talked about before is reflected in like the Board of Trustees in how much money they are being funded for privately. The university receives 7% of its funding from the state, and is supposed to be a public institution. So I do strongly believe that University of Oregon administrators should be fighting in this legislature to get public funding and to not be to have the kind of lowest levels of subsidization per student in the state, and the state in general needs to be stronger on public education.
All right, I'm trying to wrap this up, but, yeah. But I just want to clarify, the endowment itself, though, is they have the lowest ratio from the highest tuition ratio from money that comes from the endowment.
Yeah, that's my understanding, is that tuition prices are pumped up really high and that students don't see as much of that money. There's a number of reasons for that on the funding side, including university being a large institution, and the broad structures that have been changing in higher education over the past year means that money from UO is somewhat diverted to lower income schools across the state. But what that ultimately means is that on UO, our students aren't being taken care of, our workers aren't being taken care of.
All right, and then so this athletics thing, this is the radical question. What is up with the athletics? Is he just trying to sell shoes?
I mean, there's definitely a strong point to be made about Nike's influence over the university, how much money Phil Knight has made. But also, the university is relying on out of state people for a lot of its money. They charge out of state and international students like 3 times more in tuition, and athletics is the publicity that they use to do that. Instead of trying to improve education and being known for that, they are just looking for this kind of high publicity from Nike, from UO athletics, and not even the students that work in athletics themselves are seeing that money. It's just to cater to private interests.
All right, last question. Did I ask you about the that they're just trying to, they don't want to be an example of a successful union campaign?
Absolutely. And so if UO student workers, when UO student workers successfully unionizes undergrads, it will be the first public institution to do so, and will be the largest wall-to-wall union of undergrads in the country. So if you look to smaller private liberal arts colleges that have successful union campaigns, those places are being cracked down incredibly hard on, and there's this kind of community of university administrators that are coordinating on how to union bus, and University of Oregon does not want to be the first domino to fall, so to speak, of improving wages and working conditions and really having collective power return to campus. But it is something that we are fighting to make happen here, and we hope is an inspiration to public universities across Oregon and across the nation.
All right, anything else?
That's everything that I have.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. surgery, so bear with us for just one half a minute, pushing everything off the front.